Often called the nation's greatest living playwright, he is also, after a recent political conversion, one of its leading conservatives. In Il Forno, his regular restaurant in Santa Monica, California, David Mamet. Uncommon Knowledge, now. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. David Mamet has composed screenplays as disparate as The Postman Always Rings Twice and Wag the Dog, directed films ranging from House of Games to Phil Spector, written books running from The Old Religion, a novel, to The Hero Pony, a collection of poems, to Five Cities of Refuge, a Torah commentary, and composed plays that rank among the highest achievements of the American theater, including American Buffalo, Speed the Plow, and the Pulitzer Prize-winning Glengarry Glen Ross. In 2008, Mr. Mamet published an essay for The Village Voice explaining that he had changed his political views. The title of that essay, Why I Am No Longer a Brain-Dead Liberal. In 2011, Mr. Mamet expanded on his new political views in a book, The Secret Knowledge, The Dismantling of American Culture. We should note that Mr. Mamet has a new book, an ebook out just now called Three War Stories. I ordinarily thank guests for joining me, but this is your spot, so thanks for letting us join you here at Santa Monica.
Thank you for joining me.
My pleasure. The Secret Knowledge. My interest in politics began when I noticed that I acted differently than I spoke. Explain that, David.
Well, I'm very, very fortunate in my life as a Jew and having had two magnificent teachers, one Larry Kushner, who was then in Sudbury, who's now in San Francisco, and the other Mordechai Finley out here at Or HaTorah in Venice. And what they talk a lot about the underpinnings of the Torah and about the Talmudic teachings about how one should behave. And they say, well, you have to behave in such a way that you can state your opponent's views such that he says, yes, those are my views. And he has to be able to restate your views to you such that you can say, he can say, yes, those are my views. And then when you both are conversant with each other's views, you have to adduce facts upon which you agree. So do you agree that this is a fact? Do you agree that's a fact? So it's, you know, the Jews being a disputative people, right? This is what where the Western history of law comes from. It's where Blackstone comes from, right? Mm-hmm. It basically comes out of the Bible, right? It comes out of the Talmud. So, okay, so first we say, I understand your views. I understand these are your views. You understand those are my views. We agree that these are the facts. And now we're going to reason from the facts upon which we agree to arrive at a conclusion. And that's how an argument could take place, because, of course, all people argue. And that's what a democracy is. When people stop arguing, what you have is a dictatorship. So I started trying to apply that to my daily life and realized that most of what I thought was political thought was just the reiteration of recognition symbols, right? So if one looks at, because I don't think it happens on the right, but when one looks at the left, most of what passes for discourse is recognition symbols. Do we agree? Are you as part of my tribe? There's nothing wrong with that, but it's just not, it's not, I realize that's not the basis for a life lived according to political principles. It's not going to get you anywhere.
So a recognition symbol, just to make sure I follow you, I drive a Prius.
Yeah.
And what I'm doing is conveying something about what tribe I belong to by choosing that brand or by choosing an environmentally conscious.
Well, maybe,
is that the sort of thing you mean?
Sure, of course.
Okay.
But also, for example, I was talking to somebody about the movie I was going to do, and I said I was thinking of John Voight. They said, oh, John Voight, he's crazy. So, I mean, I happen to know John Voight. He's a friend of mine. He's certainly not crazy, and neither is his thought crazy. So that's an exchange. It's an interrogation.
Right.
You understand? It's like,
in other words, John Voight is conservative. That's what they really mean.
Do we agree that John Voight's crazy? I was giving a lecture in New York about political thinking very early on in my conversion, and one woman said, wait a second. Do you believe that the Earth is growing warmer? And I thought, my God, that's fascinating, right? What I'm looking at is not a request for information or the desire to engage in an exchange of views or even an argument. What I'm looking at is a cultural interrogation. Mm-hmm. Are you part of my tribe or not? Because if you're part of my tribe, we're fine. But if you're not part of my tribe, we can no longer talk to each other anymore.
Right.
Which is what, you know, Dennis Prager said, we're in the midst of a civil war. Thank God it's not violent, but we have split into two completely opposite camps who can no longer talk to each other.
So one aspect of your conversion is applying this discipline of fresh and critical analytical thinking to the way you lead your life. And then if I read The Secret Knowledge correctly, another strand of the conversion is the recognition, it's implicit in all your work and all your life, but it's a recognition that you actually like America.
I love America. I think that a lot of people on the left, I'm not willing to say they don't love America. I don't think they're evil. I just think they're wrong. And so the traditional method of political discourse where we have to come to the center seems to have gone out the window, especially in the midst of this the Obama hegemony, where we take our opposing views, we get into a room and realize that we're going to have to find some way to get along with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Because we all love America. We love America differently.
You say at one point, liberalism is a religion. You've just talked about coming to a conservative political point of view through the discipline of Judaism. So apart from anything else, Jews are still, as a group, extremely liberal. After African Americans, they are the most reliable liberal voting bloc in the country. So let me just start there. So how is it that you, it's not as if you set aside some aspect of your Jewishness, it's through your Jewishness that you came to this view. That's central to it, isn't it?
I think so, but it's not that being Jewish makes one liberal or conservative, it makes one argumentative. Like the old saw has it, two Jews, three opinions.
The Secret Knowledge once again. Quote, the good causes of the left may generally be compared to NASCAR. They offer the diversion of watching things go excitedly around in a circle, getting nowhere.
Yeah.
Okay. That's overstatement, right? Aren't you going to say
how?
America's a better place because we've got Social Security?
I don't know if it's a better place because we've got Social Security. Listen, I think that people on the right and people on the left are concerned with justice.
Right.
The people on the left are concerned with something else in addition to justice, which is called social justice. And as I believe it was Tom Sowell said, it might have been Milton Friedman, what does that mean? Doesn't mean anything. It means nothing. That a society can't be just. That law, as we Jews say, where there's law, there's injustice. Someone's going to get hurt. And law is going to get misapplied. But when you start to posit an entity which is superior to the legal system, which is superior to the judiciary system, and is capable of correcting all injustice, what you end up with is tyranny.
Mm. So what about the one great, it seems to me relatively unchallenged, even by conservatives, even conservatives would grant this, that in the last 60, 70 years, there has been one signal achievement that is a specifically liberal achievement, and that's civil rights.
Yeah, of course.
You'd grant that?
Of course.
So what are you thinking there? That somehow you grant the liberals civil rights, but that's done, and they're... Had Barry Goldwater opposed the civil rights bills.
Mm-hmm.
As a conservative, what do you say? That you're not a Goldwater conservative? That the liberals got that right, but it's no longer relevant? How is it that you can say, I'm a conservative, I'm done with...
Well, look, I'll tell you what. There was a guy talking to Hugh Hewitt yesterday, some guy called Clarence, I've forgotten his last name, who was a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer for the Chicago Tribune.
Clarence Page.
I guess. So he was a very eloquent guy, and he won the Pulitzer Prize. You know, good for him. And so Hugh Hewitt says, well, what would you say is the greatest achievement of Hillary's secretaryship of the state? And he can't name anything. And he says, well, would you say that she was, she had a failed period as ministress of our country's foreign policy? And Clarence Page says, well, what about Bush? Well, see, this, that's not answering the question.
Right.
So to say, well, what about civil rights? I don't know that civil rights was a liberal virtue. Remember, we were talking about the Dixiecrats there.
Right.
Every one of them was a Democrat.
Right. Right. Right.
You know, civil rights doesn't have to do with social justice. It has to do with the Constitution, where people are saying, wait a second, are you crazy? Are you prepared to say that 15% of the country aren't human beings? No, of course not.
Right. It is true that a higher proportion of Republicans in the Senate voted for the civil rights than of Democrats in the Senate.
Yeah.
The civil rights legislation was carried with Republican votes.
Yeah, and it's also 50-some years ago.
That's true. Okay. The nature of the right, the secret knowledge. My revelation came upon reading Friedrich Hayek's The Road to Serfdom. It was that there is a cost to everything. He wrote that there are no solutions, only trade-offs. Money spent on crossing guards cannot be spent on books. Both are necessary, but a choice must be made. And this is the tragic view of life.
Sure.
Okay, so I guess let me be slightly pedestrian and suppose that David Mamet is getting older. People's views of life sometimes darken as they get older. you're turning conservative because you've lost the hopefulness of youth.
Oh, I don't know that I've lost the hopefulness of youth. I hope that I've lost the naivete of youth. Listen, I got a teenage son.
Okay.
Okay. It's like living with the devil on steroids. Okay. I forgive my father.
I have three teenage sons.
Well, I'm so sorry. So it's like. You know, it's like they say that the daughters are God's revenge on men, right? Sons are also God's revenge on men. So he thinks he knows the answer to everything because he's never had to put anything in practice. So he doesn't understand that whether one is a parent, when one is a parent, one is always making the wrong choice. That's what the definition of being a parent, mm-hmm. right? We're being lenient when we should be strict. We're being strict when we should be lenient. We're letting them go when we should rein them in. We're reining them in when we should let them go. Blah, blah, blah. That's called being a parent.
Right.
And so one hopes that, and I think it's generally the case, that children who are never listening but are always watching may imbibe some central idea of the way life of watching their parents, or the way that they might make their lives better and make the lives better of those around them, but there's no guidebook, and there's no guidebook for civilization, with the exception of two, which are very, very closely linked. One of them is the Bible, and the other one derives from it is the Constitution. Other than that, look, the liberals say quite correctly, are you sure you want to execute people? Because what if you're wrong?
Mm-hmm.
That's a defensible position. I understand that. Well, let's look at the facts. There's going to be a cost for it. One, it may not be in a cost. It may not be the deterrence is a good thing. May not be the deterrence is a bad thing. I get it. But it may be that there are thousands of people in jails for decades and decades. Clogging the courts with their appeals and their
right.
and using up the time of society in general. So that's a choice that society makes. There isn't a good choice between the two of them.
Right.
So
right.
One of the things that makes a leader a good leader is the capacity to say, yes, nobody makes the choice but me. That's what I'm elected for. And if it's wrong, it's my responsibility to fix it in terms of some overriding goal. If the overriding goal of the leader is to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, he or she, I would hope, would make choices based upon that. If the overriding goal of the leader is, on the other hand, to completely transform the nature of the country, and the leader's going to make choices on that, that's not a person I want to vote for.
Right. David, the kind of conservatism you've reached, one more question probing your own conservatism. You mentioned the Bible and the Constitution, and you said that the Constitution derives from the Bible. There are, very broadly speaking, there are a couple of conservative positions. One conservative position is that conservatism is nothing but a recognition of reality as you can perceive it through your five senses. It's pure empiricism. You don't need to bring God into the picture at all. I don't know that he's an atheist, but there's a famous sociologist, Lionel Tiger, who says that humans have evolved in a certain way. That's why families are important. It's sociology, it's anthropology. You don't need to bring any sense of an overarching divine order into it. That's one. The other is that in one way or another, somehow or other, the human being responds to, carries the imprint of a divine order, and that responding to this divine order is central to conservatism.
Yeah, well, look, I didn't mention God. I just mentioned the Bible, which, as far as I know, is just a book. Right? There's some people who believe the book is divine or divinely inspired. I'm one of them, but there's some people who believe that the Star Wars series is divinely inspired, and they'll get dressed up as Wookiees, you know, and go on a Saturday night. So the Bible, to me, is not a book about God, because if you read the Bible, all God does is screw up. God gets everything wrong in the Bible. Why? Why does God get everything wrong in the Bible? Because he's got a problem. What's his problem? Human beings.
Right.
Okay, so to me, the Bible is not a book about God. The Bible is a magnificent, I mean, we can say that the Mona Lisa is divinely inspired. We can certainly say the Bible is divinely inspired. It's a divinely inspired book about human nature. And it's a compilation of thousands and thousands of years of folk tales, parables, and fables about human nature that were culled and put together in a certain order to try to impart a message to posterity. And they seem to have done so, because it was that message that people deserve to be free, that people are created equal and are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. That's the basis of Western civilization. So where else does it come from? Is it caused by the Bible? No, but it's caused by the same thing that's caused by the Bible, which is a divine or a human appreciation of human nature.
Is that the way you look at, you just described the Bible essentially as a collection of the greatest dramas of a couple of millennia. Is that the way you look at drama as well? You're simply trying to render human beings as they are?
I don't know what I'm doing. I just sit on, you know, my wife buys expensive shoes, and I'm just trying to pay for. She calls money shoe coupons, so I'm just trying to pay her bills.
Okay, a few issues. The family. The secret knowledge, quote, the millennia-long evolution of the human family as a means of dealing with the environment was discarded by my generation of fantasists in favor of freedom. Freedom here is in quotation marks.
Yeah.
The pursuit of which has led to misery. What do you mean by that?
Well, look around. I mean, you know, my parents got divorced a long time, like 1957, 58. Nobody got divorced. Nobody knew anybody got divorced. It's a huge tragedy. Right now, everybody's divorced, and the mothers and the fathers are all feuding, and you see them picking and exchanging their kids on a Friday night. Everybody's miserable.
So your conversion to conservative, I shouldn't say conversion because that's often a religious term. You're reaching a conservative point of view means you look askance at the entire sexual revolution?
Of course I do. I mean, I was one of its first participants. And it made everybody nuts. It made everybody miserable. Whom did it make happy? It seemed like a good idea at the time. And the interesting thing to me is not that in 1960 and 1965 everyone said, go off to college. When it's actually sex camp, we're going to call it college. Don't bother to learn anything and see how many sexually transmitted diseases you can get. Wink, wink. Not that we did that, because if you tell that to a bunch of randy 18-year-olds, of course they're going to do that. But that the greatest generation, in the words of Tom Brokaw, said, off you go. I mean, these people who were immigrants, mainly, or at least in my community, lived through the Depression, lived through poverty, lived through World War II, and then said, off you go, don't bother to do anything. So here we are, you know, in our 60s, the baby boomers getting ready to shuffle off to Buffalo, and seem to have dismantled the country from a lack of deprivation, for want of other idleness, in effect.
The secret knowledge, a man the bulk of whose income is taxed has less incentive toward monogamy. Close
sure.
quote. Explain that one.
Well, the reason guys get married is they want to get laid. But can I say that anymore?
Go right ahead.
The reason guys get married, or they used to, is because they wanted to get laid. So the woman says, yes, okay, I know that you're going to tell me you love me and you're going to write a bunch of rotten poetry and then give me some stupid flowers, right? I understand that. I understand that all you want to do is have sex with me. I understand that. You're going to have to feed me first, right? So if you look even today at the kids say, oh, no, it's somehow sexist that the boy should pay for the Coca-Cola, you know, or the bottled water, whatever the hell they're drinking now. that's taking apart many thousands of years of the understanding that men are predators, right? And that, say, the woman shouldn't have, it's called freedom for the woman, but it's actually depriving her of one of her tools. She's got to test out the guy. So if the guy says, wait a second, if I'm in love with this woman, and or I want to get her panties on, whatever, I'm going to have to display a certain amount of the ability to support myself. I have to do it, right? She's entitled to it. I'm going to do it. So he's got to get a job. If he doesn't, so the birth control pill has really ruined the economy. Because now everybody says, a birth control pill, I'm not going to get pregnant. Yay. That must mean that I have complete sexual freedom. Well, yes and no, because she may have complete sexual freedom, but she doesn't have complete sexual freedom to knock herself up and then abandon herself. Only the guy's going to do that. So if he's got to get a job, he's going to be ambitious, you know? And if he loves the girl, he wants to have children, wants to have a house, he's going to be more ambitious. If you bring everybody down to the level, it doesn't matter how hard you work, you're not going to make more money, why should he get married?
Economics, the secret knowledge. Government intervention in private enterprise is the death of private enterprise. Compare, for example, East versus West Germany, Havana versus Miami, Palestine versus Israel. Has the case not already been settled? Close quote. Block or repeal Obamacare, cut taxes, roll back regulations. You'd sign up for the whole Tea Party program?
Of course. I mean, what's the Tea Party? It's a bunch of housewives from Chicago, my hometown. They said, wait a second, I don't get it. Why do taxes keep going up? We're not getting anything from it except poverty. And I had a lot of friends who were doctors, guys in my generation who were right on the verge of retirement, and they're all heartbroken because they say kids aren't going into medicine anymore.
Right.
Why should they? Because what they got to be, whether or not they made money, was they got to be the doctor. You know, right. The most respected right. woman or man in the community,
right.
and the inheritor of the greatest title of respect, every place they go. Now they're as Hugh Hewitt said, now they're a provider and they're a clerk. They spend all their time and money filling out forms, and some schmuck on the phone in India is going to tell them what medicine to administer. Why would they do that?
Race, the secret knowledge. One of the great wrongs of our democracy was the Dred Scott decision. Here, the highest court in the land asserted that there existed two classes of human beings, the black and the white. How does that differ from affirmative action? Close quote. Okay, I'll tell you how it differs, and I'll quote Lyndon Johnson. Quote, you do not take a man who for years has been hobbled by chains, liberate him, bring him to the starting line of a race, and say, you are free to compete with all the others, and still believe you have been completely fair. Close quote. Lyndon Johnson had a point, right?
He was wrong. He was absolutely wrong. And the fact that he was wrong was proven by Thomas Sowell in several of his books, who was at that point working as an economist and a demographer of the United States government. And he tracks a lot of variables, black family unity,
right.
black male and female employment, homes with fathers in them, etc., which rise from the end of the Civil War until the introduction of affirmative action and then plummet.
Foreign policy.
Well, here's the question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Here's the question. The question is, are black people stupid? And the answer is they aren't any more stupid than white people. But the black people don't need the good-willed white people to help them. And that one might is paternalism. It's saying, I'll tell you what, guys, if you'll make me feel good, I'll be glad to put you back on the plantation. I was talking, Shelby Steele's a friend of mine, we were
right.
talking on some, to my synagogue, actually, a bunch of people from the synagogue, and a nice white woman in the background says, Mr. Steele, what can white America do for black America? And there's a long, long pause. And in the saddest voice I ever heard, Shelby shook his head. He said, leave us alone. Mm.
You know, I had lunch the other day with Tom Sowell. Mm. And that leave us alone is a quotation from Frederick Douglass, it turns
is it?
Out. Yes, yes.
Okay, so there's so the question. So there's the question, right? Because what you're saying is the black people, although they'd been enslaved they'd been enslaved for 400 years, and they were so damn stupid that they didn't realize that they were enslaved. So we've freed them now, and they have no skills, whatever. They weren't stupid. They were just slaves.
Right.
It's like going into the concentration camps and saying, oh, you Jews, here you've been put on the brink of death, and your entire civilization has been wiped out. Guess what? We're going to help you now. They need help. They just need someone to open the doors of the concentration camps.
Right.
And so the other answer is, where has it led us? You know, all of this affirmative action, all of this bullshit. Where has it led us?
All right. Politics is politics. Self-interest is self-interest.
Well, I don't know. The problem, see, and I think that Hayek and Milton Friedman really got to the root of it. And it's not simplistic to say that the root of all evil is taxes, because if you take away listen, Mark Twain said, suppose I was a congressman, suppose I was a thief, but I repeat myself, right?
Right.
If you take away the taxes, there's less mischief for those idiots to get into, for those self-seeking fools, right? You're going to get some public-spirited citizens if they can't trade favors with each other. There's nothing for them to give away.
David, foreign policy. Conservative George W. Bush invaded Iraq. Conservative Senator Rand Paul says that was a mistake. Where do you come down on that one?
I don't know. I think it probably was a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
I think you got to marshal your forces, and you have to marshal your energy, because the whole conservative idea is the tragic view, as Hayek says, is there's only so much energy. You know, if you got too much energy, you're going to come up with good ideas and ruin everything, and also the good ideas are eventually going to bankrupt you.
David, your new life. Just a few days before the presidential election in 2012, you published an essay in the Jewish Journal entitled "A Note to a Stiff-Necked People." Here's an excerpt. To those Jews planning to vote for Obama, will you explain to your children that tax-funded institutions will require them to imbibe and repeat the slogans of the left, and that should they differ, they cannot have a career in education, medicine, or television unless they keep their mouths shut? Close quote.
Do you find something objectionable in that?
Well, what I want to know is, have you paid a price for your new politics?
I might have. I mean, a lot of people don't talk to me anymore, but that's there you go. You know, it's like Hemingway said, call them like you see them and the hell with it.
Have you made new friends? What have you gained?
Sure. Well, what I've gained is, as Ruth Weiss said, somebody said to her, you know, I can't tell that I'm a professor at Harvard. What's going to happen to me if I tell the truth but what I feel? She said, you'll be free.
Back during the Reagan years.
So you're going back,
go ahead.
Wait a second.
Going back to the
Tea Party, here's a bunch of incredibly brave women outside of Chicago, Illinois, who X years ago said, you know, that's enough. All of a sudden, they're the Tea Party. It's the first legitimate grassroots movement since when? When was the last one? The Sons of Liberty, you know, in 1772?
Hollywood and Broadway. So back during the Reagan years, my buddy Rob Long, I mentioned him to you before we started rolling, wrote the following. History shows, this is during the 1980s, history shows that one out of every three conservatives in Hollywood becomes president of the United States.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, that's a good line, isn't it?
That's a very good line.
So, but in those years, literally, it was Charlton Heston, Jimmy Stewart, and Ronald Reagan, and that seemed to be about it. You're now conservative. You are a major figure in this town. Are you getting phone calls from people saying, David, you've done it, I'm going to too? Do you feel that there's a sea change, or are you one of three or four or five? Is it still single digits in this town?
It's a liberal business, you know. Why is that?
Why is it a liberal business?
Well, because it's always been a Jewish business, and the Jews have always been liberal because Jews believe in justice, and sometimes we get it wrong. The whole question of the Talmud is, what is justice? What is justice? Is it just to give a guy money so that he never gets a job? Maybe yes and maybe no. Who's going to decide? Well, there are various tribunals, and they used to come down to the individual conscience and to organizations dedicated to that purpose. Those organizations were in the main religious organizations. When you put the government in charge of that, the government is only interested in trading favors, mm-hmm. and raising taxes and getting more power.
Got it. Your work. Let's look at a clip of Glengarry Glen Ross. Set in a real estate office, Glengarry Glen Ross tells the story of salesmen desperate to sell parcels of land to unwilling buyers. Take a look at this clip, if you don't mind.
Because we're adding a little something to this month's sales contest. As you all know, first prize is a Cadillac Eldorado. Anybody want to see second prize? Second prize, a set of steak knives. Third prize is you're fired. You get the picture? You laughing now? You got leads. Mitch and Murray paid good money. Get their names to sell them. You can't close the leads you're given. You can't close shit. You are shit. Hit the bricks, pal, and beat it, because you are going out.
The leads are weak.
The leads are weak. The f-ing leads are weak. You're weak. I've been in this business 15 years.
What's your name?
You. That's my name. You know why, mister? Because you drove a Hyundai to get here tonight. I drove an $80,000 BMW. That's my name.
Capitalism, dark, underhanded, cruel. Would you have written that scene today?
I don't know. I don't know if it's a play about capitalism. It's a play about, first, and Veblen said, Dave, he said, business. He said, success in business comes from blurring the line between fraud and sharp practice. So any business is doing it. Whatever they're telling you, that's what they're doing. It's like they say when you cut the sugar cane, all the profits in the last quarter inch. So Glenn Ross is about a situation I lived in for a while when I was out of work and living hand to mouth and, you know, trying to get from one day to the next.
So the question there would be, has your new political outlook affected your work?
Here's the thing.
You've written this book of essays, but has it affected your dramatic work, your poetry, your
fiction?
No,
I don't think so, because I never wrote political stuff. The theater's not the place for politics. I mean, a lot of people, you know, get a lot of people nodding at their work because it reaffirms their belief in the essential goodness of the left and the essential badness of the right, but that's not the point of drama. I mean, drama is about human nature. It's not about politics.
So, David, what do you say? What do you say to your four? You mentioned you have a teenage boy. A century and a half ago, in the Pale of Settlement in Eastern Europe, a Jew would say to his children, "Be a good Jew, take care of your family." But we are in effect, we are a shtetl, we are a ghetto, we are not part of the wider culture. You just stay within this world and do the best you can. Now, what do you say to your teenage son about America? If you're that deeply optimistic, if you view the culture as that hostile to your own values, do you say something along the lines of, just take care of your own, do the best you can.
No, I don't view the culture as hostile to my own values. I view the culture as hostile to the continuation of America. But that's what a democracy is. I just read this magnificent book by Yossi Halevi about Israel following five paratroopers who freed Jerusalem in 1967 and follows them through till they're 70 years old. And one of them becomes a leader of the settlement movement. One of them becomes a traitor and goes to Damascus. One of them becomes a leader of privatization. And one of them becomes leader of the kibbutz movement. And all these guys, and they're still talking to each other. We've got to still be talking to each other here. We've swung very, very far towards socialism. And the rollout of this Obamacare, as Krauthammer was saying today, he said it's a wonderful thing because that every person is going to see. Every person, in effect, does see it. It doesn't work. It just doesn't. Because the question is, who's in charge? And the answer has got to be that the American people are in charge, not Obama and not Bush and not all of these people who have to raise $1 million a day and throw their coat over their shoulder and smile laughingly at the camera just as if they were a human being, but the American people. That's what the Constitution says. And if you go back and you read the Declaration of Independence, mm-hmm. you read the abuses of King George, it sounds like they were written today about our government.
The taxes, the...
Yeah.
David, would you do me a favor? Would you close this interview by reading a passage from your book?
I might.
You might? I'd like to have David Mamet read David Mamet.
Okay. The rules... This is about the movie set. The rules of behavior on the movie set are largely the unwritten law. Who shows deference to whom? When one should speak? When one should be silent? How to evaluate that which falls short of the perfect. The set is infused with a sense of commonality and dedication. This perception This perception was the beginning of my love affair, or let me say, a recognition of my love affair with America. We do things differently here. We were and are a country of workers, and as such get along so well that we became the preeminent power in the world. This came about not through a lust for power, not through colonialism or exploitation, but as a result of our ethos and cohesion. It begins with the notion that all are created equal. The definition of all has widened over time, and this widening was the essence of our republic. We, in the process of devotion to the essentially religious goal, the self-evident truth, managed to shape through our industry and through our art a new and better world.
Essayist, playwright, screenwriter, poet, director, and conservative, David Mamet, thank you.
You're welcome, Peter.
For the Wall Street Journal and the Hoover Institution, I'm Peter Robinson.